This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me what you think when you look over my shoulder at this huge hole in the ground.
It's just impressing how huge it is.
You've got a big smile on your face.
Yeah, goosebumps as well.
It's got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Goosebumps because of a vast crater carved into the landscape, a scene of massive environmental destruction, but also a tourist attraction complete with seating and signboards.
I'm a little bit speechless. I hadn't think that it's so big here. I had the map on Google Maps and I saw this big hole on the map and I say, hey, we have to go here, and it's incredible.
Where are you from?
From Pforzheim. It's between Stuttgart and Karlsruhe.
That's quite a long way from here.
Yes, we drove, I think, 3 hours.
What's your name?
I'm Jens.
Jens.
And yours?
I'm Tim Mansell. This is the Hambach Mine, the largest open-cast coal mine in Europe, a half-hour drive from Cologne in the west of Germany. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. This edition of Assignment is a tale of a coal mine and a forest. And a tale of two villages.
Bernd, hello.
Hello.
Can you speak English?
A
little bit.
Yes.
Bernd is here in jeans and a jacket and a Joy Division t-shirt.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
This is the first village. It's now called Burgerwald. For several centuries, until last September, it was called Morschenich. It's where Bernd Zervos grew up and spent most of his life. He's in his early 50s.
This is my house. My grandfather and my ur-grandfather.
Your grandfather and your great-grandfather
lived in this house. And my mother was born in this house.
Your mother was born in the house?
Yes.
I'll just describe it. It's a two-story house, red brick, not especially remarkable, but for Bernd, a very important house.
Yes.
There's a gap in the fence, and we can get through into the back garden. Oh, it's quite a sad sight. It's all boarded up. The ivy has run riot. It looks a little abandoned. How does it feel to look at the house?
Sad.
Sad?
Yes. And, yeah, das ist alles so kaputt geht.
It's sad that, as Bernd puts it, everything is kaputt.
Und ich weiß nicht, wie es drinnen aussieht, aber ich fürchte, dass da auch alles kaputt ist.
So you don't know what it looks like inside, but you're worried that it's all kaputt inside,
yeah,
as well.
Yes. I think some water is in the basement.
When were you last in the house?
17.
2017.
Yeah.
Bernd's house stands empty like dozens of others here, because this village was condemned to death nearly 20 years ago. Its misfortune was to be built above a rich seam of coal. The only way to mine this coal is to scrape away the surface to a depth of hundreds of metres. Anything in the way, a village for example, gets scraped away too.
Do you remember when you first knew that you would have to leave?
1978.
Okay.
I was 7 years old.
So you spent your childhood, your teenage years, with the knowledge that one day everything would disappear.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Ja, man sah hier nicht viel, weil der Wald halt da war. Man hat es erst sehr spät gesehen, dass das...
The mine was creeping ever nearer, but until 2013... The forest was here, so it blocked the view of the mine from the village. So if you'd lived in the village and didn't know that there was a mine there, you wouldn't have seen it.
No, you heard it.
You heard
sometimes,
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
When the machines are moving, you heard it here.
These machines, like everything else associated with the mine, are enormous. Excavators longer than 2 football pitches and nearly 100 metres tall. They started digging in 1978, but they didn't bring out the first coal until 1984. They had to begin by clearing the forest. The forest, the Hambach Forest, is an essential element of this story. Most of it has now been destroyed as a result of those decades of mining. But the last few hectares of trees became a rallying point for climate protesters from all over Germany and beyond. The protest reached its climax in 2018 after the police had been sent in to evict activists from the tree houses they'd built high up in the branches. A few days later came the largest demonstration of all. 50,000 are said to have been in the forest that day. Perhaps even more.
I think it was almost 100,000 who came in total, not all on the same day. But the 50,000 that you're talking about, yes, that was at the huge demonstration in October, when a huge number of people came to fight not only for climate protection, but also for our democracy.
This is Antje Grotus. She now sits as a Member of Parliament in the German state of North Rhine-Westphalia. Back then, she was one of the leading local campaigners against the destruction of the forest. Antje and I met in Bühr, the village where she lives, a few kilometres to the south. There's a very obvious background sound here. That's the motorway.
Yes. Und das war, warum ich aktiv geworden bin, weil die Autobahn verlegt wurde, tagebaubedingt.
Antje's saying that the road is the reason she became active in the first place, because as well as the villages, as well as the forest, the mine also swallowed a stretch of the A4 motorway, forcing it to be rerouted right, as it were, past her front door.
Hier an den Rand von unserem Dorf und die Lebensqualität.
It came right up to the edge of the village and it did huge damage to our quality of life, what with all the noise and all the dust.
By 2018, Antje's profile as an activist had enabled her to push for membership of a government advisory body that had been set up to explore ways for Germany to phase out coal-fired power generation. Antje took her seat at the table in Berlin alongside politicians, academics, industry leaders, trades unionists and other environmentalists. This is what became known as the Coal Commission.
Und in dieser anstrengenden Zeit im
September and October that year were really exhausting because the police were clearing the activists out of the forest and I was in Berlin all week and then back here at the weekends taking part in these huge protests.
The Coal Commission came to several conclusions. Perhaps the biggest recommendation was that Germany should stop generating electricity from coal by the year 2038.
Genau, das war der Kompromiss, den wir dort gefunden haben.
Exactly. That was the compromise that we reached. But both the environmental organizations and I had always pushed for 2030. That was more or less the date that was agreed in Paris in order to reach the 1.5 degree emissions goal.
So no more coal after 2038 anywhere in Germany. That was the headline recommendation which the federal government then enshrined in law. But there was something else of particular interest locally.
Es wurde mir gesagt von den Vorsitzenden und dem überwiegenden Teil der Kommission, der Hambacher Wald fällt.
I had been told by the chairman and by most of the members of the commission that the Hambach Forest didn't come within the Coal Commission's terms of reference. But then there was, after all, this recommendation that the preservation of the Hambach Forest was desirable.
This sent a very clear political signal to the mining company that no more trees should be cut down.
Genau, das war ein klares Signal.
Yes, exactly.
The consequences would be profound. In 2020, the state government announced that the forest would indeed be preserved. 2 years later, it was announced that all coal mines in this region would close by 2030. The Hambach mine had been supposed to carry on digging until 2045. The mining company, RWE, told me that by stopping early, they'd be leaving more than 1 billion tons of coal in the ground. It was all part of what the Germans call the Energiewende, the energy transition. The early general election later this month may have slowed this process. Several pieces of legislation that would have helped the country reduce its CO2 emissions have had to be delayed. There was another knock-on effect from the Coal Commission's report. The village of Morschenich would not, after all, be pulled down, even though almost everyone who lived there had by now been resettled in a new village built specially for them.
It was like a punch in the face.
This is Inga Dormez. In her early 50s, she's the elected representative from the village on the local authority. She, like Bernd, grew up in Morschenich.
Man fühlte sich wirklich ein bisschen... Man sagt verarscht auf Deutsch.
To be honest, you felt they were taking the mickey.
Tagebau war schon immer da. Also es
the mine was just always there. It was something we lived with.
And did people in the village work for the mining company? Did they work in the mine?
Ja, viele Morschenicher haben auch da gearbeitet.
Yes, a lot of people in the village worked there. And they were a good employer. People earned good money. And if, say, the football club needed a new strip, they'd ask RWE and usually they'd pay for it. There's no doubt the mine brought prosperity to this region.
In your official role as the elected representative, I can imagine a lot of people come to you with their problems. What was the general feeling in the village when the decision was announced that the old village was not going to be destroyed? How did other people react?
Viele haben so reagiert, dass sie gesagt haben, ich wünschte, alle Häuser würden abgerissen.
A lot of people said they wished that they'd pulled everything down. I felt the same. I'd rather they pulled our house down. The house where my father-in-law lived was pulled down, and it's much easier driving past there than driving past our old house. You can't help looking and thinking, oh, don't the curtains look terrible? But when it's gone, it's gone.
What about the protesters, I wondered? How did people in the village feel about them?
Die Morschenicher selber hatten gar nicht viel mit den Aktivisten und den Protestlern zu tun.
The people in the village didn't have much to do with the protesters. Now the activists are claiming that they rescued the village, but we didn't want to be rescued. I mean, obviously, this massive hole in the ground, that had to stop. It's a sin against the environment. That's beyond discussion. But that wasn't how we thought back then. We thought we were moving out so that everybody could have electricity. So that was the sacrifice we thought we had to make.
And that's so interesting how attitudes change, how when you were younger living in what was then called Morschenich, you accepted the eventual destruction of the village.
Yeah.
But now it seems to you unimaginable that that could have been acceptable.
Ja, das stimmt. Wenn man heutzutage zurücksieht.
Yes, that's right. If you look back today, you think differently about a lot of things. But we just never questioned it. We also said that the protesters came 40 years too late. They should have come earlier. If they had, then definitely a lot more people in the village would have got involved.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella. And from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tim Mansell on assignment in Germany. Unlike Inge, Bernd Zelvos wants his old house back. He too remembers when he heard that the village was, after all, not going to be knocked down.
Ja, so ganz komisch ist es auch immer noch. Also Man hat das Gefühl, alles war umsonst. Man ist umsonst umgezogen und die Heimat ist da und doch nicht da.
Bernd, you're saying that it was a very strange feeling. It was as though you didn't need to have moved. This is your home and yet it's not your home.
Yes.
Are you happy that this village is going to remain?
It's difficult. It's not the same like Morschenich before. The houses are here, but the feeling is another. The people are somewhere else.
Did it ever occur to you that you would simply move back to the old village?
Ja, man hat schon mal drüber nachgedacht, aber die Befürchtung ist halt auch, dass das Haus von innen sehr schlimm aussieht.
You've thought about it, but you're obviously quite worried about what it might look like inside. Nobody's been inside for 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
Bernd doesn't want to live in the house. He's built a new one for his family in the new village. But he's hoping he might be able to turn the old one into a kind of cultural centre. Bernd's in negotiation over that with the local authority. Because the local authority now owns Bürgerwald. It bought it back from the mining company. That's never happened before. In a country where some 300 villages have been swallowed by coal mines since the Second World War. It cost nearly 40 million euros, most of that subsidized by the federal government in Berlin.
Und die ist vor, jetzt muss ich überlegen, vor 2 Jahren ist die abgebrannt. Ich, also den Moment.
The driving force behind the purchase of the village was this man, Georg Gilhausen. He's the mayor of the local authority, and he's said to have banged on the table during his negotiations with RWE in his insistence that they didn't tear the village down. Even if they were no longer mining coal, there was still useful gravel and sand to be taken. Today, he's with a few invited guests on a short tour around what he calls the village of the future. Why did you want to rescue this village that, as it were, had been condemned to death?
Weil wir halt zwar darin eine große und schwierige Aufgabe sehen.
Because while it's a large and difficult undertaking, we also see it as a huge opportunity. And at the end of the day, if we didn't buy it, then who would? In the worst case, you could see a foreign investor coming in and making money off it, so we said, no, this village belongs to this community. We'll get financial support from the government, and it's better that this is done by the public sector and not by a private investor.
To what extent do you think the forest protest helped to rescue Morschenich?
Also diese Proteste haben eine entscheidende Rolle dazu beigetragen.
The protest played an absolutely decisive role in getting people to think again. Don't forget, in 2016, the politicians had made a decision to keep going with the mine, to stick to the plan. And yet, less than 2 years later, by which time the protests had increased, they said, OK, let's make a new plan. So, from my point of view, the protests played a decisive role.
Who is going to live in the village in the future? Who's going to come?
Also, es ist noch nicht alles entschieden.
Well, not everything is decided yet. The idea is to create a place where ordinary people can live and work. We don't want to create some kind of enclave for millionaires. We want to create a village of the future.
I wonder where people who come to Bürgerwald are going to work.
Wir wollen hier auch wissenschaftliche Arbeitsplätze ansiedeln.
So we're hoping there might be, let's say, research jobs here. Work for scientists. Other kinds of work too. Careers of the future.
It sounds a little vague at the moment.
Yeah, genau. Yeah.
So it was only late last year that the old village was renamed Bürgerwald, and my sat-nav hasn't got the message yet. So if you put Bürgerwald in, nothing comes up. So if you want to go to Bürgerwald, you have to put in Morschenich. There we go. And
please drive to the route shown.
There it is. People began leaving the village in 2015. The mining company, with empty properties on its hands, offered them up as temporary accommodation. Today, the majority of people living in the village are refugees. So this is where you lived?
Yes, this is the street where I live, last house.
This one here?
Yeah, this one.
Ruhollah Jamili used to be one of them. He arrived in Germany 8 years ago from Afghanistan and lived in Moshenich for a year. Today, he's employed by the local authority to help other refugees. And is anybody living here now?
Yeah, here live now 4 family, 2 family aus Turkey and 2 family aus Syria.
So 2 families from Turkey, 2 families from Syria. There are numerous children's bicycles scattered around on the grass outside the house and scooters. And did you like living here?
Yes, also Moshenich ist für mich wie ein Geburtsort in Deutschland. Ist auch irgendwie meine neue Heimat. Yeah.
So Ruhollah says that this village was, as it were, his birthplace in Germany. It's become his new home.
But before that decision to buy the village back, quite a lot of houses were demolished.
We've just walked round a corner, and as we came round that corner, on both sides of the street is just scrubland now. There are no houses. And you remember this street when there were houses on it?
Ja, also ich, wenn ich hier sehe, dann erinnere ich mich auch in unserem Land. Also meisten Dörfer mussten leer sein.
So Ruhollah said that it reminded him of his home country, of Afghanistan, where so many villages have been emptied of people because it's no longer safe for them to live there. And many, many people in Afghanistan have moved into the big cities. So there's a reminder here in Germany of your life in Afghanistan, what you left behind.
Yeah, yeah.
The village they built to replace what is now called Bürgerwald was until recently called Moshenich Neu, New Moshenich. But now they've dropped the new, and today it's simply Moshenich. Bernd Zelvos was one of those who helped to find the site and design the new village.
So, this village has a completely different feel.
Yes, completely different, yes.
We've driven from a village with a tradition going back centuries, and 5 minutes up the road, we're in a village that's been here for less than 10 years. Everything is square, a lot of flat roofs, painted white. I think that must be the church back there with a spire that looks like a sail from a boat.
So sollte es aussehen, yes.
That was the design.
Yes.
And this is a sign of the present, a sign of the future here. Already there are places where electric cars can be recharged. Yes. That's important. I don't think you would have found those in the old village.
No.
Okay.
Gerne.
Super. Yeah? Freut mich.
Bernd, does everybody know you in this village?
Yes. Everybody, yes.
Because you got so involved in the move.
Yes. And this is my new house.
This is your new house?
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
And this is my aunt, my brother, and my cousin.
So one, two, three, these 4 houses here, all around one shared patch of grass.
Yes.
Your brother.
And
your,
my mother.
And your mother are there. This house?
You're my cousin.
Your cousin, and the house in the middle?
My aunt.
Your aunt. The coal mine has reshaped everything here, not just this one small village. I've been given a hefty brochure full of diagrams and maps and glossy pictures. It's a vision of the future. Here there's a picture of people drinking beer at wooden tables, overlooking a field full of ponies. In the distance, there's a lake. That's not what that huge hole in the ground looks like at the moment. I went back there with Boris Linden.
You can see in the middle of the hole that the soil is very dark. That is the coal.
And all the soil that they don't need, the big stackers over there, they make new land.
They push it to one side and build up the sides of the mine.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Got it. Okay. Boris is the CEO of Neuland Hambach, the company that produced that brochure, a company created by the six local authorities that surround the mine. Its job is to come up with a plan for the regeneration of the whole area for the post-fossil fuel era.
In 4 years, the mining will come to an end. And then we will try to install one of the biggest lakes in Germany here.
Where's the water coming from?
Water is coming from the River Rhine. There needs to be built a pipeline from 45 kilometers from the River Rhine to this spot. This process will need about 40 years.
It's going to take 40 years to fill this hole with water. So what occurs to me as we stand here is that we're looking at an industrial landscape that has been incredibly important for the local economy here, even the national economy of Germany. And now a coal mine like this is seen as something unwanted, unnecessary.
Yeah, I think it's still kind of necessary because it produces still a vast amount of the energy that is used in Germany. But it will come to an end, and that's because Germany has to and wants to achieve its own climate goals, and that's why we are changing our economic structure, our energy structure.
Back in Morschenich, it's early evening. In this part of the village, cars are limited to driving at 6 kilometres an hour so that it's safe for children to play on the street. So, Bernd, as we walk around this new village, which is still being built, we're walking past a portable toilet here that obviously belongs to a construction company that's building that house. As we walk around this village, what's your feeling?
Es wird langsam zur Heimat.
So slowly it's becoming your home.
Yeah, it becomes slowly to my new home.
Slowly?
Very slowly.
Bernd, slowly getting used to his new home, wrote some of the music you've been hearing. So my thanks to him and to you for listening to Assignment with me, Tim Mansell.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.